Thank you.
This is the last lecture of the 22nd American ACC. And I think it's the what? It's the 6th of January 1961. I want to thank you very much, first and all, here for your attendance on this and the attention you've been giving me. I've got to go over and finish clearing routine with you. We're coming down here in the last few minutes of play. I have to give you the data, which you will all of a sudden be wanting in a couple of weeks. So you don't have to listen to this. You won't be wanting it for a couple of weeks, you see? First, a change in model session. A change in model session. I told you, warned you, you'd get these little changes here and there, now and then, but they're not very big ones, believe me. Here we are, and it's under rudiments. And we have three auditor clearance. Is it all right if I audit you? And the fellow says, yes. You say, do you have any withholds from me? Under three of the script of a model session, make sure that you use that to clear rudiments now, okay? That applies to all model sessions, by the way. All units using model sessions, and one and all. That isn't just for this class. Don't you think that's a good idea?
Yes.
All right. In view of the fact that this moves out before present time problem, it very often will clear the present time problem before you get to the present time problem. Got it? So that's real slippery there. Okay? All right. Now, Dick is running Chinese school on you on script of a model session, or will be. And Chinese school, that's just continuous repetition, you know. Actually, if he runs Chinese school the way real Chinese schools run, when I was a young man, I always knew I was getting near a village. I could hear the school long before I could see the village. Everybody singing out answers at a long, high pitch. All right. We have a lot of things that we really ought to continue to regard in auditing. First and foremost amongst them is the auditor's code. We should know that, and we should use it, and it'll keep us out of a lot of trouble. The auditor's code. Most trouble with the auditor's code come with the two shuns. Evaluation and invalidation. And these two shuns are probably the least understood part of the auditor's code. The two shuns. Very often ask a person what evaluation is, and they can't tell you. Evaluation is telling the PC what to think about his case. It's no more than that. And invalidation is telling him he thought wrong. Now, it's quite overt, evaluation and invalidation, and it can get very bad indeed. It's very amusing to see a director of processing who has been away from auditing beyond supervising it, try to shift gears. Because the director of processing sits there, of course, and evaluates like mad for the PC. He said, this is what's wrong with you, and this is where you're going, and so forth. Just reading a graph, you see, is evaluation. And matter of fact, evaluation is the activity, the technical word, that describes the activity of telling a PC about his graph. Poor DP is sitting there, and he's, of course, evaluating all the time. Or somebody in the new PE foundations doing an evaluation for the public. And when they shift gears back over to auditing, it's very funny, you know. At first, they had tremendous trouble getting off the auditor's code so that they could come right out and say, your irresponsibility as represented in this column leaves a great deal to be desired. As a matter of fact, how can you live this way? And it takes them a long time to get up to a point where they can be this overt, you know? And they finally get pretty overt. This, by the way, makes the registrar and the DP and evaluation personnel good evaluation personnel. They are overt, and they can be overt. Registrar sits there and she says, you need some auditing. You need about 75 hours at least. You're falling apart at the seams. I don't know how you can live. Sign on the dotted line, get some auditing. Well, this overtness, of course, is entirely different when you shift over into auditing. So they just get acclimatized, you know, to doing this registrar type of activity. And they're pulled off to audit the PC, and they sit there, and of course now they have to shift gears, and they can't tell the PC he is irresponsible. They can't be critical along this line. They can't tell the PC what's wrong with him or what to think, you know. And they just have to audit, you know. And invalidation is quite overt and quite something else, and invalidation is the usual error that is pulled by the public at large when they start to fumble with auditing and so forth. They fall into this trap quite often. The PC comes up with a cognition and they contradict him and they say that isn't right or something of the sort and chop him up one way or the other. But you know it as an ARC break. Either one of these add up in an ARC break, but mostly invalidation. You can throw a PC appetite over a tin cup with an invalidation. Doesn't take much because he's in a weak state. Down the bank someplace, and he says, oh, good heavens. My mother was sure mean to me. And the quote, auditor, unquote, says, oh, I don't know, I've always thought she was a nice woman. Then wonders why he's got somebody out the bottom on apathy. Because in normal course of human existence, it wouldn't have this much effect upon a person. But it does on an auditor-PC relationship because you're using powerful tools. The remainder of the code is itself and should be followed. But you're handling, basically, a thing called the reactive mind. And I should tell you something a little bit here, just in a brief line. I should tell you two things. One, undercut of OW and the source of OW. I should tell you what these two things are. The axiom of aberration, that is to say, the axiom, which is practically a law on the line. It is a law. Low-order value. But general enough to be an axiom. Is that all doingness will harm self. Now, when you've taught a population that one, when you've indoctrinated everybody with that one, when everybody has indoctrinated everybody else with that one, nobody can reach. You have criminals and insane, and nobody can work, and that sort of thing. This basically begins after people who do this one cease to trust any thetans of any size or description. It's the axiom of aberration. That is to say, it's that postulate which forms the core of the reactive bank. All doingness will harm self. You start looking that one over and it's wog-wog. As a matter of fact, I was trying to find this for a very, very long time. I wanted to find something at least close to the genus of the overt motivator sequence. What made this thing this thing? I wanted to know what made it this thing and how come the overt motivator sequence was this thing. And I found out very easily that that it wasn't about to be cracked. That's the first thing I found out about it. Because it's quite a serious thing. It's also a serious thing for you to know its importance. Because it chops up doingness like mad. Now, you're working with the overt withhold sequence, which depends on the overt motivator sequence. That which ye do unto others will suddenly be found in your somatics. That's the basic mechanism of that sort of thing. You hit Joe in the eye and develop eye trouble. It's an effort to keep thetans from hitting Joe in the eye. They can be taught this. Now, the universe is based on this to such a degree that it becomes, in the physical universe, Newton's law of interaction. For every action, there is an equal and contrary reaction. This, by the way, isn't even true in the universe. It isn't, by the way, you know. It isn't. It's not a true law. Because you have to say, providing the actions are of comparable magnitude. For every action, there's an equal and contrary reaction if the actions are of comparable magnitude. Because you stick a pin in your finger, and your finger is attached to Earth, why, Earth doesn't stick a pin in you. When you stamp on this planet, contrary to the reductio ad absurdum figure physics professors, which I have had from time to time, the planet does not stamp back. You got the idea? Your foot moved down, and they theorized then that the planet must move up. And I've looked at this planet and looked at this planet, and even buses going off bridges don't make the planet move out of its orbit. In other words, you had to have items and actions of comparable magnitude. This shows up also in the field of the mind. A king in the old days might say something insulting to a foot soldier, and the foot soldier didn't immediately say something insulting to the king. Didn't even feel like it. Go around and tell his comrades to the end of his career. George V bawled me out once. Pretty good, huh? Get the idea? Now, according to Cyrology, there was a stimulus-response mechanism. When you kicked Bill, Bill jumped. Stimulus-response mechanism. They knew nothing about the overt motivator sequence. It was very much hidden from view. The Catholic Church, in spite of its confessionals and so forth, didn't know anything about it. It was a hidden law. But the psychologist went along with the elementary physicist. He didn't think of laws of any comparable magnitude was involved in stimulus response. I have kicked Earth several times experimentally, conducted the test, and had several observers, and Earth didn't jump. So much for the stimulus-response mechanism. That's one of these idiot things, a stimulus-response mechanism. It hardly bears description, yet it was probably as close as psychology did get to a natural law. Now, the overt withhold sequence, or the overt motivator sequence, is a far more fundamental thing, because it tells us all kinds of phenomena in the mind. Some of the early people in the mind had observed some of these phenomena. For instance, Freud observed transference. You know, you tried to cure somebody's headache and you got a headache. This kind of thing. I wouldn't bother to try to elucidate or even use correctly Freudian technology. I've been away from it too long. But just take my word for it that it's a matter of... They had already recognized that when they tried to cure somebody's stomachache, they had stomachaches afterwards. They recognized this. They had no further explanation for it that made any sense or did anything about the stomachache. Well, when you cure somebody's stomachache and then you get the stomachache, that's pretty bad because it means that even curing stomachaches is an overt to you. And what you have at work here is this axiom of aberration. The axiom of aberration says that all doingness harms self. Now, that's worked out mechanically to prove it conclusively. Now, we've had enough lessons on the track that once we had actually circulated this law and believed this law and agreed upon this law often enough and long enough, we ourselves began to believe it obsessively. We would do such a thing as I did one time in a knuckleheaded sort of way. I hate to bring up whole track, but I withhold from you. I found out last night that I did some withholding from you from time to time. Not very serious withholding. But when you're describing cases, because there is such a thing as a tape, and people hear these tapes and so on, you usually mask the case, you know. But I'd gotten so accustomed to doing this that on several occasions, not too many, I have given you something that happened to me, you know, as something that just happened to a PC. Just automatic response, you know, it happened to a person and this is the circumstances of it, no importance at all. So I might as well level you with this in spite of the fact that past lives cause a lot of people to leap sideways as though stung. Anyway, I was not minding my own business, but was in the middle of a battle. And there was a battle cruiser. This is all space wagon stuff. It was a great big battle cruiser. We were weren't too small. We were about 3/4 of its size. Lying alongside of it, nearby, and action had commenced. It was very close indeed to be engaging in electronic cannon warfare and that sort of thing. And I yelped through the speaker system to the crew on my own ship forward to fire a salvo at the cruiser's bridge that was alongside of us. While they might or might not have missed, but the ricochet of the electronic shells being fired at the cruiser alongside did a carom that wiped out my bridge. In other words, the shells glanced off the enemy ship alongside and came right on back aboard and wiped out our bridge. It's not a very smart thing to do. We lost that battle. We really lost that one. You get what this is, see? Now, we do something knuckleheaded like this. As a matter of fact, I did it in World War II. This is a nice key, and it's exactly almost the same thing. But it scared my guys more than it scared me. Mostly because I was still interested in the other subject. But I was fighting a submarine. I was going at flank speed and went over the submarine. And of course, you preset depth charges, so they went about 80 fathoms or something like this, you see. I went over this submarine, and actually, when I went over it, got a blip on the fathometer, completely aside from the chemical recorder and other methods of fighting submarines, and found out his depth was 35 feet. Well, he wasn't at 80 fathoms, and those depth charges weren't about to hit that submarine. And he'd been prowling around outside of a port waiting for some nice, great, big, juicy, edible aircraft carriers to come out, see? And so I was rather anxious to get him, games condition. And I went over the top of him, flank speed straight ahead, and fired off all the barrage and the K-guns and everything else. Well, now these K-guns carry a 300-pound depth charge on an arbor, and they are fired with black powder, And the depth charge sails way up into the air. There are three lengths of charges, and these were extreme charges, the biggest and most black powder charge. So as I went over the submarine on a forward course, everything got fired, of course, including the K-guns. I got a blip on the fathometer. And I'd, whoo, we've missed. He's right up on top, and we've set the barrage to explode way down deep. So I said, right, hard, rudder, at flank speed. And of course, this rather big greyhound I was conning leaped around in a turning circle. And I glanced back aft to make sure everything was okay, and there my boys stand on the after battery and the fantail around the K-guns, watching that arbor come straight toward them. £300 of TNT. Now, I didn't even have time to wiggle the helm. And it went under us, almost hit the side. We were gone off that immediate spot at the time it exploded, but it was just by sheer accident. It only bent a propeller or something like that. Went around in the other circle and dropped the shallow barrage and got the sub. Now, you'll understand what I'm saying. This is confirmatory, see? We've taken an action against a submarine, and we almost get blown up. And on the whole track, we have taken actions against battle cruisers, women, armies, and other dangerous things. And gotten ourselves blown up. You know, it's something like we fire the shotgun and we don't notice that the barrel has been bent and is pointing at our temple. Well, in some knuckle-headed sort of a way, we say to ourselves, what do you know? I've only been fooling people with this law. All doing this harm self. Now I know it is true. All doing this harm self. You know, that's pretty broad. But that's the condition a psychotic is in. That's why he commits suicide so easily and why he destroys himself, why he tears up his body and everything else. He thinks of doing something, he promptly tears himself up. Got the idea? Well, it's just this one law at work. Or it could be other laws, there are other explanations and so forth. But as far as I know at this time, that is the senior monitoring postulate for the reactive bank. Naturally, OW works. It only works, however, as long as that law is in place. And theoretically, if you could reach into the bank and flip that law into a total null, people would cease to work on OW. Their OWs would no longer be effective on them. They wouldn't be restrained by some kind of a foolish mechanism. They would no longer be restrained below the level of their consciousness. So therefore, they'd have to be men of pretty good will, because a Thetan does his own withholding. Nobody else around here is withholding. It's just a Thetan. That's him. That's your PC. He can go to such a state, as I have seen a race already in the condition of, where you have to do all the withholding for the person. The person can't withhold anything. They're totally irresponsible, so you have to do all their withholding for them. Therefore, you armies have laws and rules, and governments pass laws and so forth, and very often man is happiest, particularly an aberrated race, is happiest under a regime of harsh laws. And you wonder, how on earth could they stand that? All of these harsh, mean, vicious laws, how could they stand them? Yet the government is stable and goes on for a very long time. And yet we see some benign, beneficent, beautifully kind, gentle, help everybody government. And up jumps the revolutionary and wipes the government out. And we see in Roman history that the mean, tough governments would last for 30, 40, 50 years. Nobody challenging them. And then a real good government comes in that's going to repair the roads and straighten out all the harbors and fix the populace so they have jobs and so forth, and it lasts for 18 months. Got the ideas. Now, it's not because it's so tough it doesn't destroy the opposition. That's too obvious an action. It's that the people themselves obviously wanted a tough government to do withholding for them. Now, some people of a very low intelligence or reasonability, you actually can scold them and cheer them up. You say, you do that just one more time, we're going to drop you off the end of the bridge. You're going to bounce all those rocks down there, too. And they say, whew, thank you. That's because they're afraid of themselves. Now, at a very low level, then, the inability to withhold becomes criminality. So this law, the axiom of aberration, becomes the cause and source of criminality. And one of the common denominators of criminals is they can't work, they can't do. So they get the idea that if they are going to do anything at all, they have to be totally irresponsible. They can't be responsible for any of their actions because they can't take any actions, you see. No actions can be taken. It is the Thetan himself who is withholding. And he will continue to hold on to this law until he can trust himself. And will get rid of this axiom of aberration only when he has confidence in his own activities. Right? You see how this is. So it isn't enough just to go into the bank and flip this law out and leave everybody irresponsible and so forth, although theoretically it might be possible, and roll up everything in all directions. If the Thetan himself does not have confidence in his ability to act in a good or decent way, he will not permit the law to be knocked out, even though the law is causing him and is the only cause of his acting in an indecent way. You see how this thing, of course, exceeds reason. And that's why nuttiness appears nuttiness. And I told you the most we knew about insanity in 1955, 54, was that it was incomprehensible. We knew that. It was incomprehensible. Just look at it and recognize it's incomprehensible and stop worrying about it. Now we can go further than that. Further than that. Because O.W. was getting so important, I did not want you or your PCs or people in Scientology to become totally convinced that you must never do anything to anybody, any place, because this would, of course, result in a no-doingness, no-action, totally apathetic condition, wouldn't it? So it was part of my responsibility to look up this subject and to continue to look it up and continue to bear down on it until I found the basic which underlay it. And that is the basic which underlay it. You're welcome. It's quite important to you. OW is a limited theory and subject. That law is quite limited. It is junior to practically everything else in the bank. But it is senior to all aberration. All doing this harms self. People begin to believe this, and they cease to act. And then they can only act automatically. Then they can only act on somebody else's determinism. And then there they go. Because synthetic determinisms are never real determinisms. The only badness in the world is somebody considering something as discreditable and then saying it is the person. And then the people get into a synthetic valence that never was the person. In newspapers are a wonderful example of this. They are purveyors of synthetic, discreditable valences. You look over a great many of the people they are writing about and talking about and so forth, and they're not this way at all. Newspapers are sort of a running engram in the society, not a communication channel. This is nothing condemnatory of all reporters everywhere at all time. It only condemns their editors. Because maybe a lot of these fellows would write a proper summation of the situation after investigation if they themselves weren't under orders from higher up. Synthetic valences. So the only bad valences are synthetic valences. They never were the person from whom they were taken. So we have a bad man, and he's a bad man because all doing this that he does will harm himself, therefore he has to be in a valence that he doesn't do any part of, so therefore he can do something, but then he's totally irresponsible for it. He's in a bad valence. You get the idea? He is basically good, but he's abandoned the whole works and he got into a bad valence. All right, somebody else comes along and describes this bad man and makes him worse, you see. Now we've got a worse valence kicking around. Who knows? Maybe Attila the Hun was a good babysitter that was nice to children. Maybe he wasn't, too. But if so, then he was probably in the valence of the Roman general he was fighting or something. That he had been described to him as a very, very, very bad man. From childhood, he had had this image of this horrible man. And then the Roman general fighting him picked up the valence of Attila, who, wearing the Roman general's valence, is a very bad man, and was then further sinned against by the Roman scribes. And the Roman general really did get decayed on his own valence. Could be, you see. Now that itself is the dwindling spiral. The dwindling spiral of valences. Valences are handled by help. I've already given you a lot about O.W. Valences are handled by help. Before I get off the subject of O.W., just let me interject something here. I told you there was a second one. There is an undercut to O.W. O.W. undercuts. What is the final action of O.W.? The final result of O.W. is a blow, a skip, a get out of here, a beat it, a scram. So leave and must not leave is the final consequence of OWs. Individual commits overts, 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 withholds, withholds, withholds from, and commits overts against, withholds from, and overts against, withholds from, eventually blows. He gets the idea he must leave. Must leave. One of the deepest undercuts on OW, if a person cannot run OW, this is theoretical, has not been tested or tried, but I always try to give, particularly before I take a long trip, the last information available on Scientology. By the way, this is one of the things which I do. You normally will find it on my desk or something of the sort written up, which is the last and highest level of advance is generally described before I step on board airplanes. Mostly because I've shot too many of them down. This is such a passover to you. Theoretically, you might find a case that can't run OW. Now, we already have found cases that couldn't run OW. And we have also found cases that couldn't run thinking an unkind thought about a terminal. See, we found them, but they, again, in some way could run OW. You get the idea. So these two processes have theoretically, one has moved to the other and it's moved back to the other, and we haven't found any cases these didn't absolutely undercut. But because we have found people that couldn't run one, although he could run the other, and there aren't any here, I wiped that out at once, couldn't be anybody here that's like this. You've got a case lower than this, but the only thing you could think of was leaving and not leaving. He could think of leaving and not leaving, but he couldn't think of doing something to somebody and not doing something to somebody or withholding from people. You got the idea? He couldn't even think of thinking unkind thoughts about people. Well, if so, well, then theoretically, he could think about leaving and not leaving. You got it? That's totally theoretical. I haven't done any work on it at all. It is what's known at this time as an unnecessary undercut at our present level of observation. But there it is. The only test made on it, by the way, move body ridges. So hard. And I just wondered if the whole body wasn't suddenly going to lose all of its mass. So I don't think it runs very easily. It would be something on the order of get the idea that you must leave, get the idea you must not leave. And it moved body ridges with enormous velocity. Perhaps this would clip down into the effort band at overweight and that sort of thing. That's all, however, merely just observation on an experimental process line. The whole subject of help remains what it is. It has been very, very well explored. It's been tremendously successful. And I probably, however, ought to give you a condensed anatomy of help. Might help you a great deal to find out why help runs. Now, we already know that a profile records valences. If you're going to shift a profile, you must shift a valence. If the profile doesn't shift, then the valence hasn't shifted. You got the idea? A profile on the various graphs that you see is a picture of a valence. It is not the picture of the preclear until he's clear. Follow that? Therefore, you can sometimes have a falsely high profile. Somebody's in a theety-weety valence. And you audit it a little bit, and it goes whir, click, crash, you see? It almost rotates like this E-meter. It goes off the top and comes onto the bottom. Next thing you know, you've got somebody who was reading like King Kong. You'll see this phenomenon. You'll also see a middle graph profile shift down and shift up. But because the processes you're using are very rapid, and because you usually only test in an HGC at every 25 hours, your gains are quite positive, and you've moved valences left and right, that you don't see the downbeats. The downbeats that you do see, however, are ordinarily and routinely the result of ARC breaks if they've been hanging up for any length of time, you see. Because these downbeats, if valences are really moving, maybe the fellow would only read like that for a half an hour. He'd only read on this downbeat for a half an hour, and it'd be almost impossible to maintain it because you've already got a valence shift going on. It's like aberration. It's very difficult to hold in place. I don't know how people manage it. Aberration is very, very easy to move. All you have to do is hit it on the button. It seems to be there forever. It seems to be there in concrete unless you actually push it and you find its shadows. They fold up so fast that it's very hard for people to maintain them in the face of good auditing. It's very easy for people to maintain them in the face of poor auditing or weak processes. That's why I tell you, you run the PTP with the biggest drop. And the goal that the PC wants with the biggest drop, of course, you're auditing straight at something which folds up rather easily. But it doesn't fold up unless you're on it. And if it is sufficiently magnitudinous, the PC's attention is so thoroughly wound up in it that you're auditing a lesser PT problem on a person with a bigger PT problem. You see, the bigger PT problem takes precedence. Savvy? It's a very good thing for you to know, when you get some experience on it, why you're going to blink at the speed with which one of these things folds up when you really hit it on the button. And it's going to give you some enthusiasm for hitting it on the button, not grinding it off the top with a nail file. Now, the reason help works, and this is all very pertinent to help, the reason help works, you kind of wonder, how the devil can this fellow keep on being Uncle Joe? You know, it must really take some doing. Maybe after we've got this all wrapped up for 200 or 300 years, why, maybe the HGCs will only be in business aberrating people, you know? Maybe they get tired of being themselves. They haven't gotten tired of it yet. They're so far from being themselves that they're complete strangers. And you have to introduce them to himself, you know? When a valence moves off, it does so because alloying or alliance failed has been remedied. Now, any alloyance, like you alloy metal, one thetan and another thetan, you sort of pour them together, or one thetan gets all wound up in mountains, you know, he's alloyed himself with mountains. It's perfectly simple for him to get into and out of a mountain until he fails to alloy himself. And then he thinks he can't unalloy himself, and he gets stuck. He associates himself or identifies himself with another identity or another thing. And this is very easy for him to do, both to identify himself with and to cease to identify himself with, if you get the idea, until he hits a failed identification. Now, let's say the thing he thinks he should be is a fellow just like General Snodgrass. General Snodgrass, a great overpowering personality. I had a grandfather once, the king of the Belgians, that answered this up remarkably well. He was an overwhelming personality. He bristled all across his front lip in the most marvelous military mustache that anybody ever saw. When he kissed you on the cheek, you felt you'd been thrown on pikes. Really quite an overwhelming fellow. Well, trying to help him did nothing but result in failures after a while. But for a while, sitting out and not trying to help him in any way, you see, one could pretend, you know, to alloy himself or identify himself with this grandfather. But then actually trying to help this grandfather, that was all right too, you see. It's all help impulse up to this time. And then stack up a whole bunch of failed helps on him, because he was very easy to fail to help. He was a man who had lots of complications. Next thing you know, you didn't know whether you were growing a mustache or not. See? Be all based on the impulse to help and the failure to help. The failure to help would be what locked in the valence. Help and identify are very closely associated actions. The final effort of helping anybody is to be him. I was one time in a hot shop or I don't know, what do you call these? Johnson's restaurants. And a lot of tourists, some very cute kids, had swung in there out of their car, and the place was full of people. And one of the little babies in this family had been seated in a high chair. And here he was in the high chair, and Mama was feeding him with a spoon. And he was quite tired, but very cute. And Mama was feeding him with a spoon, you know, and opening her mouth, you know, for him to open his mouth. And he finally opened his mouth, you see, and pick up his head and open his mouth and take a spoonful of porridge or whatever he's being fed. This is going on for quite a while, and I glanced around, and practically everybody in Johnson's restaurant was opening their mouth for the little baby. See, they were trying to help him so hard that they were being him. Get the idea? Because a very tired little kid who was still being a good kid, he was something to help, you know. The only reason they could do that this easily is they were already stuck in valences of this character, don't you see? They closely associated themselves with that sort of valences. Now, let's reach it one more stage, and let's suppose, which did not happen, but let's suppose this little baby had been completely unwilling, you know, to eat, or let's supposing, even worse, that the little baby had suddenly choked on the porridge and turned blue, and it had to be removed from the restaurant with great haste in order to get his breath back and so forth. See? Practically everybody at those tables would have been almost saying da-da to each other. Got the idea? It would have been a sudden stick. See? All his help, 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 help would have run into a sudden failed help. Now, of course, this is a very light thing I'm talking to you about. Spaceship spinning over and over, out of control in the gravitic field of a large black sun that is just frying at a hot, low-level fission. Another ship standing by outside the gravitic field with this falling ship, part of its own squadron, falling into the sun, you know. Nothing you could do about it of any kind whatsoever. Actually, the reason one is never able to do anything about it is the latent image. That's where your facsimile comes from, a latent image. You're always trying to see what is happening over there by seeing what is happening where you are. And you'll make a picture over there and try to look at it simultaneously where you are. That's the primary best use of a facsimile. If you don't believe that, have a PC sometimes. Make a facsimile outside of the birds that are singing out there, and then bring it in and look at it. You'll find him sitting right in the engram he is stuck in, because he'll get the one of the birds and it'll alter his. And you get a different picture of birds, don't you see? There'll be different birds or something of the sort, and this will cause him to look at the bank, and you ask him what else he's looking at, and he's liable to be able to dish out to you the engram necessary to resolve the case. This is old gag stuff, because you've made him go through the action of taking a picture over there and then looking at it here. Got the idea? The latent image is what this is all about, and I could talk to you for an hour or two and probably make it much clearer as to how this goes about, but I just mentioned the latent image in passing because it's the fruitful use. It's an engram, or a facsimile, is an effort to defeat space and distance and time. Processes which you're running handleless. Something for you to know. Now, help, then, is an alliance or an alloying which has come to an unsuccessful conclusion, terminating the intention to help. When the intention to help is terminated, it's failed help, and it is then succeeded by a feeling that one is individuated from it. It is the effort to claw off of it. You're identified with it, now you want to get away from it, so you start committing overts against it. It's really the effort to leave. And there are many harmonics of this. The effort to leave, doing overts, doing withholds, trying to leave, doing overts, doing withholds, trying not to leave, in spite of doing overts and withholds. This gets all cluttered up, don't you see? But it's an effort to individuate after one is de-individuated. See? So the fellow's going right along, perfectly happy being a clock, and all of a sudden he finds nobody wants to know the time. Or he tells the time wrong, he feels, or somebody is loused up because he found the time out. But a failed help occurred around the vicinity of a clock. Fellows will go on making cuckoo clocks or railroad rails or anything else so long as they feel they are helping. And when they cease to believe that they are helping, they will then begin to commit overts in an effort to individuate from this thing that they find they can't do it easily.
If the effort to individuate succeeds, failure to help. One must have failed to help something before he starts committing overts against it. That is a very exact, precise statement. That is where overts and withholds come from. So O.W. runs upstairs to failed help. And then failed help runs upstairs to help. Some people try to solve this by never intending to help anybody. And their whole track gets goofed around those areas. The whole track will get solid around those areas. They decided the best way to handle life is never to help anybody. And boy, have they got solid time tracks. You can find areas in your own time track somewhere on the back track where you made this solution. Where you decided, well, you intended not to help anybody, that's it. Never intend to help anything or anybody, and you had it made. Man, that stopped all the communication flow and stopped the basic game, and that was it. Now, a Thetan who has lost his ability to recover from having associated himself with something will commit overts against it. Got it? But the overts against it are the main reason why he can't get out of it. It's the worst solution he could adopt, but it happens that he adopts this solution. Now, never to help anything leaves the track in a goofball state. It really louses up the track. To help and fail to help brings about a desire to leave or individuate. And therefore, help O.W. and failed help run close together, right next door to each other, and valences shift. And as the valences shift, so shifts the profile of the individual. Now, it happens that the more valences he gets out of, and the more valences he passes off along the line, the more he becomes himself. But sooner or later, he will go through a period of degradation. Because only when a Thetan was totally degraded, couldn't help anything, couldn't get away from anything, couldn't even commit an overt against anything, couldn't withhold anything, these degradation factors, couldn't withhold self or anything else. Well, I can't be me anymore, so he skipped it. And in that state of very low-level degradation, and believe me, it's really, in that very low state, why, he passed over into some basic valences. You'll find such a thing uniformly. Degradation occurs around the rock. The rock is the first shift of valence, the loss of identity of self and the assumption of identity of something else. Of course, it has the mechanisms of failed help and O.W. and must leave and can't leave and all these various items that work around. Life without help practically can't be lived. But even more importantly, life without helping anything is intolerable to a Thetan. Therefore, the rehabilitation of the ability to help, getting rid of the overts, the withholds, getting rid of these periods of failed help, doing these other things, are all very germane to a case in aberration. Now you should understand why a Dianetic assist pre-session 38 works so well. You just sail into one of these points of degradation and clip it. You'll find that if you've hit it on the button, you've got a conviction that he has failed to help. It's not necessarily anything, well, his mother was beating him. This is obvious prima facie evidence that he has not helped mother. We used to think that this motivator was the thing, and therefore Dianetic auditing took a long time. You can actually audit out the motivators. But factually, it was his effort to individuate from the situation and the personality which took place at that time, and the realization that he could not do so that leaves him in possession with the engram in PT. He couldn't get out of it, so he still got it. his overts and that sort of thing pinned it. But they were an effort to get away from it and individuate from it. You see how that little mechanism works there? Well, that's what you're trying to solve with these Dianetic assists. You solve these, of course, just exactly as I have told you in these lectures. You don't have to go into the whys, but it should tell you what you're looking for in there. Now, help is the last rung of sanity. When a person is no longer able to help in any direction, to all intents and purposes, we can consider him a gone dog. This is so much so that in the case of low-level strata of life, you can only separate out the sheep and the goats by just looking around and finding which of them are still able to help. They're okay. And those that aren't able to help, but only are destroying and nattering away at things and so forth, they're hopeless. This is so positive a statement I'm making that if you were to have a sweeper around, for instance, who always broke brooms and never swept the floor, I would never open a door for you. I would never help out anybody else. I would never try to cheer you up. So forth. You better get rid of him. Kick him out and get him audited. But don't have him around without giving him some processing. Because there you have somebody who is in a failure to help, exclamation point. And that's all he dramatizes. He's proving to one and all that all help is a failure. And he's trying to individuate from everything. Now, this is the last rung state. That's why I say, whatever your meter reads, a question or two about help put to the individual tells you at once what his case state is. If he can't define help, and he can't do anything about help, and he can't help anybody, and so forth, and it all seems rather doubtful to him that it's possible, why, you've got this kind of case. There is interest, communication, control, help, then failed help, and on south from there. Inverted control, or anything you tell them, they're going to do something else anyhow. Inverted communication, you would be amazed how many lies they tell about you and how vicious they are, even though you don't hear about them for quite a while. Inverted interest, well, that can become very peculiar indeed when it gets that low. Very peculiar. If you don't believe it, read Freud. All of his interest was studying this subject of inverted interest. It's the totality. That's why he didn't get any place. He was hitting it too low. Okay? Now, these things are the things you need to know in order to process PCs and do it successfully. We haven't wiped out all the data of Dianetics and Scientology. We have merely charted a route, not only through life, so a fellow can pilot it, we have also charted a route through the data we have found out about life so that you can bring somebody off rather rapidly. I wish you lots of luck. Thank you.